It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're getting a preview of History Camp Iowa 2016, taking place on Saturday, November 5th at the State Historical Museum in Des Moines. There will be a mix of professional and amateur historians sharing their expertise. And Rebecca Stoker teaches history at Winterset High School. She'll be sharing research that she did when she got her master's degree. It's about the role that Hollywood played on the home front and abroad during World War II. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello.
And I think when we think about Hollywood in World War II, there are definitely some iconic films that come to mind. But you want to show people that it really wasn't just the movies that were being made that was a contribution, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a whole lot more than just that going on. You had stars that were entertaining the troops both at home and abroad, raising money at war bond rallies, even Joan Crawford setting up a day nursery for children of mothers who were working in these factories. So there's just a whole lot more going on in Hollywood than just the films being produced. And I was kind of bothered by the idea that that's all we remember, because the sacrifices of these stars were quite immense, and some were even overseas fighting as well.
Now, of course, a lot of people on the home front, pretty much everybody on the home front during World War II, had to make sacrifices. Was this kind of an organized effort in Hollywood, or was this every person just doing what they felt was their part?
No, this was definitely an organized effort. You had something in Hollywood called the Hollywood Victory Committee, and they definitely worked with different stars to get them on different entertainment circuits, both at home and abroad. And you also had the Hollywood Canteen, which specifically got groups of actors and actresses together to entertain troops at this building that they had bought called the Hollywood Canteen. It was open every night, even Christmas, and 2,500 men would go there a night. And you had all sorts of stars there serving donuts, washing dishes, entertaining troops, dancing with them. This is definitely something that a lot of stars were working together to do.
Let's talk before the entertainment part of this. I mean, stars were traveling around the country trying to sell war bonds. What did those efforts look like?
Yes, these efforts were amazing. When I started doing this research, I had no idea the amount of money that they were able to raise. One thing that they did was create the Hollywood Caravan, and this was a train that took Hollywood stars on a tour across the United States, and they would stop in cities that had basically promised that they would be able to raise at least $1 million for war bond sales. In Washington, D.C. in 1942, there was a $1 billion war bond drive that got started, and on that first day, the stars present raised over $1 million in one day. So their ability to raise money just by showing up and being there was astronomical. And you see these statistics over and over again with all sorts of different war bond rallies that they did. Carol Lombard did one in Indianapolis, her hometown, and raised well over $1 million. So these were very, very beneficial to the war effort and to try and raise those necessary funds that I don't think we would have been able to get had it not been for their involvement.
Now, of course, Hollywood was a much more successful town during World War II than it was, say, during World War I.
Mm-hmm.
Were these unprecedented efforts, or was this something that had started really from the earliest days of Hollywood?
I would say they definitely took place in the earlier days of Hollywood. You definitely saw in World War I stars working to raise Liberty bonds and things, what they were called in World War I, and making appearances, making films for the war, all of that. But I would say that it definitely increased a lot during World War II. And a lot of that is because of what you mentioned. Hollywood had done nothing but continue to grow in popularity. I mean, by this point, 80% of the world's screen time came from Hollywood, films made in Hollywood. The impact that they had and the amount of audience that they could reach had changed dramatically since World War I.
Let's talk about what some of the Hollywood stars did abroad during mm-hmm. World War II. And I think that's something that we see depicted in films about this era, a few films for sure. But what kinds of efforts were they participating in there?
There really was a wide variety. John Ford, for example, the famous director John Ford, he was working not only as a soldier and fighting, but he was also doing a lot of filming. And he created a number of documentary films on the battles that he was in. He was in the Battle of Midway and created a documentary named that, The Battle of Midway, and won an Academy Award for it. He did a lot of filming at D-Day as well. He was on the first landing there and did a lot of filming of the soldiers coming ashore. So he was doing a lot with that. You also had soldiers or actors that were actually in the war. James Stewart and Clark Gable were both bomber pilots in Europe. And Henry Fonda joined the Navy and was active in the Pacific. So you had a lot of that going on. But you also had stars traveling around to different battlefields and areas within Europe and North Africa and the Pacific to entertain the troops. And probably the most famous one of those was Bob Hope.
Well, and speaking of being very close to the battlefields, I mean, the work of filmmakers like John Ford, but I'm sure there were others as well who took this incredible footage. It's so terrifying to think about going into battle with a camera in your hands.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. And he did say, an interviewer said to him, you know, this is quite extraordinary that you went into these battlefields and did all this filming. And he was very humble about it and said, you know, it was what I was getting to paid to do. There was nothing extraordinary about it. That's what I was supposed to do.
Well, you mentioned earlier Joan Crawford setting up a day nursery.
Yes.
Now, there had to be people more qualified to set up day nurseries than Joan Crawford. But
right.
Tell me about that.
Maybe more qualified, but not with as much money.
Okay.
And so what Joan Crawford did was finance this. She tried to find people to help finance it. She couldn't. And so she said to the people that she got to volunteer, she said, I will finance all of this if, you know, we'll actually get the people together and volunteer to make it happen. And she did. They found an old fraternity house that they converted into this day nursery. She furnished it with her own money. She even set up a desk there and was there multiple days a week to oversee the running of this place to make sure everything was running smoothly. So, yeah, maybe other people more qualified, but she had the money and was willing, and so it was actually very successful.
Now, that's a pretty surprising story. What are some, is there another story that really surprised you when you dug in and did this research?
Yeah, I guess a story about Betty Grable really interested me because she would go to these smaller camps. She didn't want to go to all of the big, well-known camps. She wanted to go to some of the smaller camps where stars didn't get to as much. And one of the camps she showed up at, she peeked out behind the curtain to see as people were showing up, and the first 12 rows of seats were completely empty. And she said, why are those rows empty? They told her, well, those are for officers and their family and friends. And she got very angry and said that she absolutely would not, she had not come to perform for the officers and their families. She had come to perform for, you know, the average soldier who was putting his life on the line every day. And she said, fill those rows up with normal soldiers, not officers, and I'll perform. Otherwise, I'm not going out there. So that was quite spectacular. Another story about Catherine Grayson, who found out that African-American people were not being allowed to attend one of her shows at a camp, and she blatantly refused to perform unless they were allowed in. So some pretty spectacular stories.
Now, as we talked about at the very beginning, it is the movies that were made during World War II that we do remember.
Right.
Those were really important, too, especially to morale on the home front.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was a huge, huge deal. And Hollywood knew that, and the government knew that. And they did, to some extent, have cooperation between the two, which didn't happen a lot. But big, big impact for morale. You have people overseas that are just, you know, they're desperate to escape the war even for a couple of hours. And so there were massive movements to try and get films over to the soldiers. They would be parachuted in, they'd be flown in, trains, whatever, to get to these soldiers, but also the people at home, missing loved ones, needing a distraction from the hardships of what was going on. So a lot of these films being produced were purely escapist films. They were films that were just meant to be fun, and they had nothing to do with the war. Things like Meet Me in St. Louis or the Andy Hardy films starring Mickey Rooney, these were comedies, very much entertaining. But you also had films that, a lot of films, that spoke directly to the war effort and worked to boost American pride. So you might, you had a number of films, for instance, Destination Tokyo, starring Cary Grant, that showed the Allies coming up against all odds and being victorious. And, of course, people loved to see that. They loved to see that we were winning. But even films like Bataan, which showed all of our soldiers getting killed, still had this heroic element to them and sent this message that even though we lost that battle, we died heroically, and we died in the pursuit of freedom. So these were the messages being sent through these films.
If you could tell your high school students one film that they should watch from this era, what would you pick?
It's kind of tough. I kind of have two.
Okay, I'll let you have two.
Okay, one would be Mrs. Miniver, and this was made about the British home front. It had a huge impact on Americans' feelings toward Britain in the war. It wasn't that we liked Britain and everything, but this film made us really sympathize with what Britain was going through, and it made it more real to us and made us more willing to want to go and fight with them. The other film that I would really recommend is a film called So Proudly We Hail. It stars Claudette Colbert. It's about nurses in Bataan that have to go against all the odds, too. It's not just about the soldiers. It really shows a different picture of who else was suffering in this war and who else was giving their all for freedom and for the United States. And I just love it because I think there's a lot of raw emotion in that film, and it just gives you a different perspective on who else was fighting besides just the soldiers.
Rebecca, it must be so fun to think about sharing the research that you did with a broader audience, because I know a lot of people write master's theses and they don't necessarily get read. So is that what drew you to History Camp?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to share it. I have been an old movie buff my entire life. My undergraduate paper that I had to write to get out of undergrad was about movies during the Great Depression. And so then this dissertation was about, movies in Hollywood during World War II. So to get to share that passion and realize that other people are passionate about it, too, to get to meet those people, that's so exciting for me. I'm obviously a teacher. I teach at Winterset, and so this is what I do. And to get to do it with a topic that I researched and I love, it's just fantastic.
Rebecca, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Rebecca Stoker teaches at Winterset High School. She'll be sharing her research on Hollywood in World War II at History Camp Iowa, coming up on Saturday, November 5th at the State Historical Museum. You can find out more at historycamp.org. And we will continue getting a preview of some of the many topics that will be covered at History Camp in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Be your neighbor's daughter. Yet in the desperate hour of our country's need, they rose to magnificent heights of courage no woman and few men have ever reached before. From their heroic deeds, their boundless love, their women's hearts, comes this true
story. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're getting a preview of History Camp Iowa 2016. It's taking place Saturday, November 5th at the State Historical Museum in Des Moines. There'll be a mix of professional and amateur historians sharing their expertise on a wide variety of subjects. And Jerome Thompson will be one of the presenters. He is a professional historian. He was the curator of the State Historical Museum for many years and is retired now. He's going to be sharing a treasure trove of letters written by a woman named Sadie Ray Scott in 1919. Hello, Jerome.
Hello.
Thank you.
Good to be on your program.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for being here. And who was Sadie Ray Scott?
Well, Sadie Ray Scott was a 28-year-old stenographer who worked for what was then called the Iowa Historical Department. And Sadie Ray accompanied Edgar Harlan, who was the curator of the historical department, on a trip through northeast Iowa, ostensibly for two purposes. One was to scout out possible new state park sites, and the other was to attend a conference of the Iowa Conservation Society in McGregor. And that meeting was actually included officials from Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. And part of that was to develop a strategy where they would approach Congress about creating an Upper Mississippi River National Park. And so she was along to record the meetings. And they traveled by motor car in an Oakland touring car from Des Moines through to Tama and over to Maquoketa and Bellevue and on up the Mississippi River to McGregor. And on part of her trip, they also rented a houseboat for a few days of relaxation on the Mississippi.
So we had a couple of days of relaxation on a work trip.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And so she took along her typewriter, of course, and also a Brownie camera for which she captured a few Kodak moments. I discovered these about 6 or 7 years ago when I was researching some of the Edgar Harlan papers at Drake University, and I saw the letters and some photographs, and I just kind of tucked that away saying, yeah, don't have time to do it now, but maybe later I can get into it. And so about a year ago, I went over to the special collections at Drake and started going through it, and I discovered Sadie Ray Scott.
She was the stenographer, so it was her job to just take notes on everything that was going on?
Yes, she did take notes on that. There is some of the official record that is in the Edgar Harlan papers at the Research Center in Des Moines, which were where his official papers are located. But these were almost 100 pages of letters that she wrote to her mother in Des Moines.
In 1919, I can imagine that that car journey was far more arduous than any of us probably can even imagine at this point. How long did this trip take? How long were they out and about?
They were out from late part of July and then back on the 3rd of August or 4th of August in Des Moines. And she describes some of the roads and road conditions. And, you know, at that time, highways weren't numbered. They were named. Highway 30, which was the Lincoln Highway later, or at that time was called the Lincoln Highway. And she even describes going from, I think it was Guttenberg, to get to McGregor and talking about getting lost a number of times because the roads weren't marked. And on other times when it rained, well, you had to put the hood up over the car, but you also had to put on chains to get through the mud.
So what is the sense that you get from her? I mean, if she wrote 100 pages of letters, obviously she was excited about what she was seeing and what she was learning. Sounds like maybe she had a real sense of adventure for this trip.
I think it was her great adventure. She, you know, she would comment on the landscape and how pretty it was on the Iowa side of the river in McGregor, but it wasn't so pretty on the other side. Not that she was prejudiced or anything, but she wrote in a very, you know, personal way, and you know, she described her traveling companions and the places that they stayed, and what struck me were the number of places that were included on their trip that people can go see today.
Such as?
Well, they first of all started out at a place called Moorhead Caves near Maquoketa, which is now Maquoketa Cave State Park. They went through the little village of St. Donatus. They stayed, actually, when they were in Maquoketa, they stayed at the Decker Hotel. I had lunch there probably about 5 or 6 years ago, but you can also stay there, too. When they were in Dubuque, they stayed at the Hotel Julian that she described as being the most elegant place she's ever seen. But she puts on the caveat that she hadn't seen the new Hotel Fort Des Moines in Des Moines yet to compare. The other part, which is especially surprising to me, was that when they got back from their little houseboat trip, there was a telegram waiting for Edgar Harlan from Senator Larrabee, inviting them for Sunday dinner at the home that was built by his father, Montauk, which is one of the State Historical Society's historic sites. And she goes on for a number of pages describing how she felt like Rip Van Winkle and how she'd stepped back in time 100 years. And she describes, Mrs. Larrabee, who is still alive, grandchildren and other parts that were part of the household there at Montauk.
Oh, wow. In describing the landscape, you mentioned that she was visiting sites that may become state parks, and obviously some of them did. Does the landscape sound the same as it looks today?
Oh, I think pretty much so. When you get over into the karst area of eastern Iowa and the cliffs and the hills and the valleys, she describes very well. They also, when they were at Bellevue, had loan of a launch, and it was a hot July day, and they slipped off their shoes and stockings and dangled their feet in the water, and somebody grabbed her camera and took a picture of it.
Oh, nice. So at History Camp, you'll be sharing some of those pictures, too?
Yes.
Wonderful. Do you have a favorite letter from Sadie Ray?
You know, that's a tough question to ask. There were sprinkled throughout their numerous humorous accounts. One of them that I thought was quite special was that when they were at the meeting at McGregor, Governor Harding was there, and she was describing in the letter to her mother that Governor Harding gave a very good speech, and she thought it was interesting how many of Mr. Harlan's thoughts he included at it. And Adeline Harlan, who is a 14-year-old along on the trip and kind of was Sadie's roommate for most of it, I think they became pretty close, quipped that, gee, that was a great speech. I wonder who wrote it. Speechwriters are not new.
Right. Jerome Thompson, thank you so much.
Thank you, and please come to History Camp.
Jerome Thompson was the curator of the State Historical Museum for many years. He's retired now. He'll be sharing this treasure trove of letters written by a woman named Sadie Ray Scott in 1919. And this hour, we are getting a preview of History Camp Iowa. You can find out more at historycamp.org. And now we're going to focus on some recent history. Dirk D. Ringenberg is a retired U.S. Army major. He's a highly decorated infantry officer and the mayor of Madrid. He's also getting his Ph.D. in history at Iowa State University right now, and he's going to be sharing history that he lived at History Camp. Mayor Ringenberg, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Charity. It's an honor to be here.
And you're going to be sharing the history of a battle that you actually fought in. Tell us about it.
That's correct. It's the Battle of Bulak-Calais. It happened in May of 2005. I wrote the story a couple years later as a tribute to a soldier who was there who was subsequently killed in Afghanistan, and I felt it was important to capture the deeds of the men who were there that day, but also in response to a lot of misunderstanding that I had been hearing over the years as far as what we were doing over there. A lot of people thought we were victims being sent into something we had no control over, and I wanted to just lay the record straight, not to glorify war in any respect, but to really tell the people how the military conducts operations in a very clinical fashion, and that we were very capable and very able, and we created some breathing room for the Afghan government in 2005 to conduct successful elections. And that was really the main reason for the story.
You and I could talk for at least an hour about this battle, which was a 12-hour battle back in 2005. But we don't have an hour to talk right now. So can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of what happened that day?
Certainly. My organization, part of the 173rd Airborne Brigade, was stationed in southern Afghanistan. My company, chosen company, was a quick reaction force. We had about a 45-minute notice that a small element had been surrounded by a Taliban force, and we flew into the Argandab River Valley and with the express purpose to destroy that Taliban element. And that's essentially what we did. And a lot of things happened during the fight. There was a river. There was a lot of vegetation, which really caught some people by surprise, is that we did most of our operations in these thickly vegetated river valleys that had nothing to do with the open arid desert that people associate with Afghanistan. Long story short, the paratroopers found the enemy. We fixed them, and we conducted a very skillful operation to destroy that element, which was much larger than anybody had anticipated. That set into a series of events that led to many of these fights happening over the summer of 2005 as the Taliban tried to regain control and as we prevented them of that.
You are a primary source for this history. You're the kind of person that a historian in this instance would interview about what happened that day, but you're also reporting on it or sharing this as a historian. How does that change how you think about your experience?
Well, I originally wrote it in the first person, and then when I submitted to the Center of Military History, they wanted me to change it into the third person, and that was kind of odd. And I also had to submit logs and all kinds of other statements to corroborate essentially everything that was written. It's very hard to pull yourself out and look from a omniscient point of view, but that's what I tried to do, and I received a lot of input from all the soldiers. You know, that's how we keep in touch. Facebook has enabled all the soldiers to keep in touch, and we share our perspectives. And the fact that we were a very highly trained organization, which was, and I don't mean to belittle it, but that was a operation that we did routinely. I was able to give a little bit of perspective and relay it into written form that really captured a lot of people's attention.
This didn't happen very long ago. And, of course, we have events like this that continue going on. This is current events, or these are current events, but it is also part of history. So I'm curious for, you know, people who've been following the news who might go to your session at History Camp and learn about this particular battle. What do you want them to take away?
Well, a couple of things. One, this is happening right now. There are U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan fighting, creating that breathing space for the Afghan government to develop. That's happening right now. Number two is they're not victims. They're following the orders of the civilian leadership, and they're executing operations at a very high level of performance. And with Veterans Day coming up, that's what I think the main takeaways are, is that this is a and other than that, the terrain. You know, that I'll have a lot of pictures. I have video camera footage from that day that I've added into the briefing to show what the terrain really looks like. So those are some of the main things.
Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity.
Dirk D. Ringenberg is a retired U.S. Army major. He's also a history PhD student at Iowa State University. He's also the mayor of Madrid, and he will be presenting at History Camp Iowa, sharing his experiences, but also giving campers a historical perspective on something that happened not so long ago. And now we're going to talk about a little bit more recent history. At least it seems pretty recent to me. Pamela Reine-Kerberg is a professor of history at Iowa State University. She specializes in research about childhood. She's also a History Camp alumna. And this year, Pamela, you're focusing on the lives of teens in the 1980s. I lived that history. That doesn't feel quite like history to me. Why focus on that period?
Well, the 1980s in Iowa were an incredibly difficult decade, and I'm interested in finding out how young people experienced that decade, because, of course, we've had a lot of rural depopulation in the 30 years since, and I do believe that a good amount of that can be traced to people's experiences in the 80s and the hardships of the 80s.
Now, of course, we had a lot of bad hair in the 1980s and some fashion mistakes. But also what you're saying is this, of course, was the time of the farm crisis in Iowa. And kids were doing what kids do. I mean, they were going to high school and getting their hair permed and listening to boy bands. What kind of sources can you go to learn about how the farm crisis, for example, actually affected their lives?
What I've been doing in the last year or so is taking a look at high school yearbooks. When you're looking for sources by teenagers for teenagers, your sources are really limited. Eventually, I'm going to be getting to an oral history project with people who lived through this. But when I started thinking about what kind of sources are there, the high school yearbook was the source that I hit on. And they're amazing.
So what exactly are you finding in these high school yearbooks?
Well, most of them have bits and pieces about the farm crisis, and they really show that the students of the 1980s were well aware of what their parents were going through. And what I've found is that the emphasis of the yearbook is really very much dependent on local conditions. In Ottumwa, you have young people who are aware of plant closings and who are writing about that in the yearbook. In Ames, university town, they're very concerned about the state budget and regularly commenting on how the state budget is affecting their ability to take the classes they want and to have the activities that they want. On the other hand, out in Harlan, which was deeply affected by the farm crisis and the agricultural stress of that decade, I found a wonderful 1985 yearbook, and the theme of which is Something's Missing. And the Something's Missing yearbook is a farm crisis yearbook. It's about all of the stresses that that decade was imposing on that community.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Pamela Reine-Kerberg. She's a professor of history at Iowa State University. This hour, we're getting a preview of History Camp Iowa 2016, which is coming up on Saturday, November 5th at the State Historical Museum. If you go to historycamp.org, you can find out all about the event and register if that's something you're interested in. People volunteer to share presentations. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. History Camp Iowa, the second annual History Camp Iowa, is coming up on Saturday, November 5th. This is an opportunity for history buffs and historians to get together and share their knowledge about the things that they're really passionate about. People volunteer to give presentations, and then other history buffs come and go to all of those different presentations. Again, that's coming up on Saturday, November 5th. You can find out more at historycamp.org, and you can still register to attend the event, although all the presentations are scheduled. And we're getting a preview this hour, talking to different presenters about the things they'll be talking about at History Camp. With me right now, Pamela Reine-Kerberg. She's a professor of history at Iowa State University, and her presentation is about, it's called Iowa in the 1980s, Teen Edition. And Pamela, just before the break, we were talking about going back to these yearbooks, and you were talking specifically about a very special yearbook you found from Harlan, Iowa, from 1985. They called it Something's Missing. Here's this small community going through the farm crisis. So do you feel like the teenagers in Harlan, Iowa, understood where they stood in history, that maybe they were witnessing a way of life passing?
I think they really did. And in fact, I've been able to interview the woman who was the editor that year. Her name was Beth Ellsworth. She now lives in Portland, Maine. And she said that they decided on this particular theme through long discussions with their yearbook sponsor. And they really wanted to develop a yearbook that represented the truth about what their community was experiencing. They were a consolidated high school. It was Harlan and all of the little communities to the south of Harlan. And they really felt that they couldn't talk about all of the good things that were happening in the community without also making without also acknowledging the hard things that were happening. And that yearbook, front to back, is a farm crisis document.
When you talk to people about history that is this recent in the 1980s, a time that a lot of us remember well and take for granted and maybe don't think we lived through anything particularly significant during that time, are there challenges to putting that kind of history together?
There are. A lot of documents don't make it into historical societies within that short a time frame. You often have to turn to oral history. You have to interview people to find out what happened. You have to deal with some feelings that are still kind of raw for people. But at the same time, we are at the point, we're 30 years out from the height of the farm crisis. And if we don't start gathering that material now, it just becomes much harder to do so later.
Pamela, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Pamela Reine-Kerberg is a professor of history at Iowa State University. Her presentation at History Camp is Iowa in the 1980s, Teen Edition. And now the kitchen is the heart of many homes. That's where Alyssa Yanni is focusing her research. She's a graduate student in history at Iowa State, and she'll be doing a presentation on colonial kitchens in Virginia. Hello, Alyssa.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And I know part of your presentation is comparing an average person's kitchen to the kitchen of an elite family in colonial Virginia. What can we learn from that comparison?
Well, from that comparison, we can see how much they have in their kitchens, because I looked at Jefferson and Monticello and then the average person's kitchen. So we can see the distinctiveness between how Jefferson had slaves working in his kitchens, and he could travel to France and learn their cuisine, as opposed to the normal average day person. All they had was one table, maybe a fork to share, while Jefferson could host these elaborate dinner parties with 20 courses.
Well, Thomas Jefferson is an interesting example of the elite because he's kind of the elite of the elite. Did you look at other elite kitchens, or do we just have a lot better references for what happened at Monticello?
Well, Monticello is like the prime example that I focused on in the paper. I looked at other elitists, so those who could afford to own slaves and their differences between people who were barely making it by.
When you look at the kitchen of an average family, I mean, you said a fork to share. That sounds like there really wasn't much in there. What else do you see?
They would have maybe a table if they were lucky, hardly enough chairs to go around. There was no counter space. Women would be, you know, kneading dough on their legs if they had to. You didn't have napkins that was using your shirt.
Wow. And what were they using to cook? I mean, was this cooking on the hearth, or would they have had a stove?
It was mainly cooking on the hearth. As time went on, families were lucky enough they would have a baking oven, but most did not. And so it was just their one pot meals and a few implements to use for that.
What do you think the most interesting thing that somebody can take away from this comparison is? What did you learn?
I think the most interesting thing is just seeing the differences of how these families all survived, because even the people who didn't have anything, they still made it by. They were still very grateful for what they had. And then looking at the elite, just their fortunateness, I think, is the biggest takeaway.
Looking at the utensils in, let's say, the elite kitchens, I know you looked into utensils in kitchens. Was there anything really surprising that you found?
Just the uniqueness of some of the things they have. Like, you know, they had waffle irons and pie molds and jello molds and things that you wouldn't think about having for that time period, but they did exist.
All right. So maybe there were even cluttered kitchens back in colonial times.
There might have been. At least in Monticello, he had a nice stuffed kitchen.
All right. Alyssa, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Alyssa Yanni is a graduate student at history at Iowa State University. She will be presenting at History Camp on colonial kitchens in Virginia. And finally, as we complete our preview of History Camp, and there's a whole lot more going on at History Camp than just the things we've heard about this hour, we know that the railroad changed the nation in many ways, but one of the things that it revolutionized was mail delivery. Phil Berleski is a retired minister in Vinton, Iowa. He'll be teaching Iowa History Campers about the mail-by-rail system. Hello, Phil.
Good morning, Charity.
Well, thank you so much for being here. How did you get interested in mail delivery by rail?
I'm a railroad buff, and just about any facet of railroading or transportation history excites me. I'm also a stamp collector, so that's a sub-interest.
All right, so you brought those two interests together.
Yes.
So tell us how the mail-by-rail system worked, because it was quite the elaborate system.
It was quite elaborate. It started slow. Early on in the 1830s, mail traveled by stagecoach and boats and horseback and that sort of thing. Railroads started carrying mail about 1835 or so, and gradually developed into a nationwide system as railroads moved west. The time came where just about every train, passenger train in the country, carried mail. Actually, that was by congressional action in 1838. So, for example, in Iowa, we had a lot of railroad lines that were built especially east-west, but also north-south. Almost every town and village and city in Iowa was served by a railroad at one time, and almost every passenger train carried mail. There was a time when, say, up to maybe 60 years ago, when railroads were still carrying about 93% of all the mail some distance, there was a time when you could mail a letter anywhere in Iowa before, say, 5 o'clock, and it was guaranteed to be delivered the next morning at another destination in Iowa or beyond, Chicago, Milwaukee, Kansas City, St. Louis, the Twin Cities, Omaha, you name it.
So mail delivery was better then than it is now?
Not to knock the present system. I think our U.S. postal system is still one of the best in the world, but it was really great when railroads offered passenger service to almost everywhere, and almost every passenger train carried mail.
So I guess, of course, if you're
at that time, if you were mailing something within Iowa or within a certain region in the Midwest, you could get that kind of really incredible fast delivery. If you were trying to go beyond Iowa...
Well, maybe 2 days. Mail a letter in Des Moines, it would probably be in New York City 2 days later.
How was the mail handled on the train?
A couple of different ways. Some of it was what was called closed pouch or sacked mail. It was sacked at the post office, taken to the railroad depot, put on a railroad baggage car, and just carried by the railroad to whatever destination, then unloaded, taken to the post office, and sorted. The interesting thing about railroad service was they also had what were called railway post office cars. The railroad supplied the cars, but the postal the employees aboard the car sorting the mail were postal employees, and it was like a post office on wheels. You could actually mail a letter, either hand it to the clerk or put it through a mail slot mail car. You could buy stamps from a clerk on a RPO car. They would sort the mail and dispatch it along the way. Many times, trains dispatched mail at stations where the train didn't stop. They had a special kind of V-shaped hook that they'd open one of the mail doors and extend that hook, and it would catch a mail bag on a mail crane at some intermediate town, and at the same time they'd throw a mail bag off and made this exchange. The train might be going 75 miles an hour and make this exchange of first-class mail.
How many people would have been working in the mail car?
A small one had one person. Some of the larger ones had a clerk in charge and maybe six or eight mail clerks. And they were usually assigned to different areas. One sorted newspapers, one sorted first-class mail, one second-class, and so on.
So it was really a fully functional post office on the rails. The people who were working in these post offices, they must have had to. Did they spend the night on the train too? How did they manage their lives?
They depended on the run. Both night trains and day trains carried mail. For example, some of the trains carried a postal car between Chicago and Omaha, and they worked through Illinois and across Iowa. It was a, 8-hour run, 9-hour run, or something like that, and that was a day's work. Other mail routes, because of the number of stations and that sort of thing, they split the routes into sections. The longest RPO route was from Williston, North Dakota to Seattle, Washington, and there that route was divided into three different routes, three different sections or divisions.
So people would trade off and then head back on the next train and that kind of thing. So I can imagine that this kind of service was something that it was pretty easy for people at the time to take for granted. In researching it, is it difficult to find records?
Not really. There is a mobile post office society of collectors and that sort of thing. But fortunately, there are a lot of government documents around, and there's kind of a subset of some of us rail fans who write books and articles and that sort of thing about mail. And there's still enough postal clerks around to remember the good old days.
Well, how long did this go on?
It started. The first official what we would call an RPO car actually ran between Chicago and Clinton, Iowa, and that started in 1864, and it was extended and operated across Iowa and throughout the United States. It was very, very successful. RPOs lasted until about 1967. By that time, so many railroads had discontinued passenger trains that the post office department pretty much pulled the plug. The last ones in Iowa operated in 1970. The last RPO in the country lasted until 1974. It ran between Washington and New York City.
Well, Phil, this is a perfect example of one of those historical subjects that I had no idea I was interested in, but I'm finding that it was so much more interesting than I could have imagined. When you started compiling all of this research, what was your goal? Where did you intend to share it?
At first, just for my own fun, just curiosity and so on. It was just fun to do. I collect, there are special postal stamps or cancellations and so on, and they're quite collectible. And I guess that's kind of how it started. And I remember, I'm old enough to remember, actually, seeing trains carry mail and talking with mail clerks and that sort of thing. And that piqued my interest, and it just expanded.
So is this going to be your first time going to History Camp? I know it's only been around for a year.
I did one last year on trolleys and streetcars, especially the streetcars and interurbans that served Des Moines area. But Iowa once had a lot of electric railways.
So this is really a great opportunity for so many amateur historians around the state to share their research. What did you get out of the experience of sharing last year?
It was fun. There were a few people that have an interest in trolleys, or maybe kind of remember riding on a streetcar or whatever, and came for nostalgic reasons. I had some interesting conversations with some people afterwards who have shared some of their memories. I expect the same thing will happen now. And I went to as many other sessions as I could. I enjoy history. This is a great opportunity, the History Camp at Des Moines. It's just a wonderful opportunity.
So are you already thinking about what you might want to do next year at History Camp?
Maybe.
So
thinking about maybe streamlined trains across Iowa, many, many of them once operated here through Cedar Rapids, Marion, Fort Madison, and so on.
All right. Well, we'll be looking forward to that. And when people go to your session this year and learn about the mail-by-rail system, what do you want them to take away from it?
An appreciation of, first of all, our own mail system, but what railroads meant in terms of hauling mail in the past. Christmas is coming up, for example. The amount of Christmas mail that once traveled by rail is phenomenal. I mean, they ran huge, long, extra trains of mail. Well, today, people email and text and that sort of thing. And first-class mail isn't what it used to be. Some trains once a week would carry a special car loaded with nothing but Life magazines for distribution. Well, Life doesn't exist anymore.
So it really gives us a real glimpse into the past. Thank you so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
We've been talking about History Camp this hour. That's Phil Burleski. He's a retired minister in Vinton, Iowa. He'll be sharing with Iowa History Campers the mail-by-rail system. You can find out more at historycamp.org, and you can still register for this year's event coming up on Saturday, November 5th. This is Talk of Iowa.